Hello, welcome to Casterbus. I am Christian Corley. And this week, in a few moments' time, I'll be chatting with James McLean. We will be talking about The Terminator, mainly about The Terminator and a few tangential adjacent movies and other media as well. Before we get to that, this is our latest podcast. This is this week's edition of Casterbus. There'll be no news update this time, although I will be back with that in a few days' time. And also look out in the coming weeks for my interview with Chris Chapman about the upcoming Box of Delight 40th Anniversary Edition Blu-ray disc. Now, if you are listening to this on Patreon, you've got this early. Okay, you got this 2 or 3 days earlier than everyone else, and you've got extended content as well. This is a lot longer than what is going out on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Amazon and all those other places midweek. So you get this early, you get it ad-free, and you get extended content as well. Now, if you want a part of that, our Patreon is free. You get all of that for free in our Patreon. We do have a paid option where you get a couple of extras, but to get the best out of Casterbus, you get it for free. Use the Patreon service, www.patreon.com/Casterbus. Sign up for a free account. You get early podcasts, full-length podcasts, and ad-free podcasts. Okay, that's all from me. Now over to me and James McLean.
McLean, how are you doing, James?
I am doing equally okay.
Oh, okay. All right.
No. That's a very old reference now, isn't it?
Well, you say that. I actually came across, I was on Facebook the other day browsing through my my sort of retro gaming and classic TV feeds, and Betty Boo popped up going, the actual Betty Boo, I don't think that's her real name, explaining how she created Doing the Do.
Yeah, I've seen, I mean, yeah, she's still active, and I've seen her pop up on social media as well. But yeah, the song, by that whole anecdote of it being retro, is the point, you know.
Yeah.
If it was physical, it would be of an antique status, wouldn't it, by now? It's antique, something's over 25 years.
Oh, is it?
I think there's a definition. I don't know. I'm kind of regrets sort of making that statement without having backed it up, which seems to be the way that the world works at the moment. But
cite your sources.
Exactly.
So yeah. So anyway, we got onto Betty Boo accidentally. Do you know the reason I watched it, actually? Just continue.
Oh, well, I was out by 75 years. It's at least 100 years old, so...
We are in no danger of this podcast becoming antique.
Well, vintage is the word I was after.
Is it?
Is
right,
20 to 99 years old. So if it's over 20, it's vintage. So, yes, it would be vintage.
Okay, we're halfway. The reason I kept going on about Betty Boo is because I think the tune to Betty Boo was used on a video game, Amiga game, called Magic Pockets, which was one of those games that looked amazing, but I bought because I liked the way it looked. I actually couldn't play it at all. Found it absolutely rock hard to play.
Do you want to explain why you sound like you're on the run?
I sound like I'm on the run. Okay, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, my voice may sound a little bit boxy because I'm using a different microphone today because I'm on the run.
Okay, well, that's local, that explained.
From the local.
Careful what you say here. Yes. I don't know. I just thought I gave you a perfect segue into our topic, but you've lost it. You've dropped it.
I know. Sorry, yeah. Well, no, because I was building towards one myself, you see, concerning games and... playing games before you see movies and things like that, which would have eventually got me back to The Terminator.
Yeah, you see how mine would have been a more expedient route.
It would, yeah. Don't know why we didn't do that. Because I'm on the run.
You didn't pick up on it.
I'm on the run from a time traveling cyborg.
Yeah, they're difficult ones, aren't they? Because they time travel, and you'd think for a franchise that would give it loads and loads of options, but I think it's become one of its greatest problems, its greatest burdens, is the fact it's trapped in this sort of time travel framework that it seems unable to escape from, which is interesting because, you know, the heart of the Terminator really isn't the time travel. I mean, the original story may be to some degree, but the actual heart of the story, which seems to have been the thing which every other film has compounded on, is not really the time travel thing. But then I don't know. I mean, I suppose culture it has been, hasn't it? Every few years we get the Skynet AI memes pop up, and which has probably been its legacy, but it's also been its burden. That first film, really, time travel is not a massive factor in it in terms of, you know, what you're, what keeps you tense in it, what keeps you watching it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really a film like any other in terms of having a hero who overcomes massive odds. And the two key differences really is that the massive odds is that bloke from Conan the Barbarian, and the hero is female, which isn't completely unusual in science fiction, but it did stand out in those days in 1984, because it's 40 years, which is why we're talking about this, it's 40 years since The Terminator came out.
It's a fascinating film when you think of the sort of gender dynamics. If you look at Alien, and there's this whole notion of symbolically Alien being kind of like codified for sort of male rape, essentially, with the use of the facehugger and impregnation. Mm-hmm. And even though obviously within the story that can happen to anyone, certainly the first film, there was always this notion of, and the sort of orifice-like and genitalia approach that Geiger had to his work.
Yeah.
It sort of situates itself very much on a sort of male abuse. And yet Terminator is kind of the flip, and it's almost like, you know, we've had the memes recently, you know, who would you rather be stuck in the woods with, a man or a bear? You know, the Terminator is kind of really sort of saying, well, Terminator's both, I guess. But it is very much that sort of plays on the fear that a lot of women have of men being physically stronger, and the sort of cultural and sort of the power of men within society and the fear of it. You know, it plays very much on that sort of gender line of, you know, women's fear of men to some degree, the sort of unstoppable force, which some have. So it's interesting how the two films, which kind of are symbolic for that period in terms of sci-fi slash thriller, because both of them kind of sit in that space. You know, Alien is a sci-fi horror, I guess, but it's kind of also both of them are sort of sci-fi horrors, but both of them, you'd be hard to pass each bits of that out. They are both very sci-fi, but they're both very sort of horror infringed. Like you say, it's the unstoppable antagonist in both, which is kind of the linchpin of those films more than the sci-fi. I mean, you could make Alien a male killer and put them in an oil rig, and it would feel not dissimilar to Alien. And likewise, you could, you know, just make the Terminator a really narky guy and a woman trying to escape from them, and it would still carry the same tension points to some degree. You could still plot it in the same sort of ways, minus eggs and metal and stuff, but, you know.
Well, Terminator 2, just the Robert Patrick's character, he's kind of narky, actually, isn't he?
Yeah, and again, it's male, and obviously they flipped it in Terminator 3, and I would sort of say Terminator 3 doesn't really work for it in an odd way. And I don't know whether that's the way they did it or the casting, but I think possibly to some degree there is a sort of cultural understanding, a sort of almost innate understanding, everyone watching Terminator, of that sort of notion of male killers and female protagonist, vulnerable female victims.
She is a slightly two-dimensional villain, Terminator 3, unfortunately. But I think Terminator 3 is, I mean, I do want to focus on the Terminator, but before we do that...
Yes,
Terminator
of course, 3, because of its... But we've not said because it's the anniversary.
Yeah.
But I mean, it'll be in the title of this podcast. You know, we have some professional standards
for that. Yeah.
In your car.
Terminator 3, I think, has that thing. It's your famous maxim of you can have a bad middle and a bad beginning, or bad mid and a bad mid, but you can't have a bad ending. Yeah. I think Terminator 3 has a superb ending, and I think that's
it. Does absolutely. Yeah, it does, definitely. But we can't deny as well that the rest of it is not that good for various reasons. Especially since it adopts very much the Terminator 2 framework of the good Arnie, and it just feels like a slightly flat in comparison. But yeah, the ending is a kicker for it. But yeah, so as you were saying, we're really talking about the first Terminator.
I watched it recently on I think it was Amazon Prime. And it was partially because I knew we were going to be having this chat at some point, but also because I wanted to, because it's a good film, and I hadn't seen the original for a long time, not beyond the television, where you always get those cuts. So I felt it was quite important to take the time to watch it, because it is a very good film, and it's maybe, it kind of gets forgotten about because of Terminator 2, I think, as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, going back to the Alien comparison, yes, isn't it? It's Aliens, and Aliens does, to some degree, not to the same extent, overshadow Alien in the same way, Cameron.
It's Cameron again, but also in both cases, they overshadow the sequels.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They're high points, aren't they? The 80s was quite good at doing fairly good blockbuster sequels, you know, Empire Strikes Back being another one.
That was 1979, wasn't it?
1980 for Empire Strikes Back, but you know, who's quibbling? Okay. I think that is interesting. I suppose with Alien and Aliens, perhaps where it hasn't hit so hard is that Aliens is actually quite a different movie. I mean, yes, it's got that bigger scale like Terminator 2 has, but you've got to sort of pull on the sort of Vietnam War genre in that's been embedded in there, which isn't in the original. While Terminator 2 does kind of feel like Evil Dead compared to Evil Dead 2, where the second one just feels like a bigger, better version, a bigger version of the first one. I suppose arguably with Terminator 2, you do have that good turnaround of having Schwarzenegger as the hero character rather than the antagonist. But beyond that, it's very much the same film. Even down to the endings, where you're into sort of like an industrial space to actually get rid of the damn thing, and the chase along the highway is very similar in both of them as well. So they're very interesting. But yeah, I think you're right. Terminator itself gets overlooked. And I was just thinking, it's kind of funny because, you know, Terminator, as I say, sort of speaks to that, as we said, the sort of unstoppable male antagonist horror character to the female victim protagonist. And yet I was going to bring this up on the podcast, you know, which is the better Terminator? Is it Terminator, or is it Spielberg's Duel? Because they carry very similar approaches, and yet one of them is very heavily gendered to masculine because of, you know, truck drivers, car driving, very much a sort of masculine zone, especially in the 70s. And yet, as I say, the Terminator speaks very much to that sort of female fear. So you've got the kind of male fear of sort of different aspects of masculinity, almost like a hierarchy. And, you know, the truck driver being considered very masculine at the time. We will, but other people won't. Remember the Yorkie adverts that were in the 80s. You remember where it would be the truck driver breaking his Yorkie chocolate bar. Yeah, I kind of hope our listeners have. We've got younger ones, but I imagine you're all boring 40 to 50 year olds. Like Christian, because I don't want to consider myself like that, but you know, you got there before me. Cool. But yeah, so there is that sort of weird thing, isn't it? That Terminator very much is that sort of female fear of being stalked, essentially. It's a stalker film. Yeah. While Duel is also a stalker film, but it doesn't, we don't consider it a stalker film because it's about assumedly guys, because you never actually see the guy in the cab for Duel. For those who don't know Duel, because you know, you might be too young, or so old you don't remember it. It was one of Steven Spielberg's first, and it's basically a guy who is chased by a lorry driver, truck driver throughout the film and can't, unstoppable and can't get rid of him. It's a good film.
It is.
But I think it's interesting that they're very similar, but in terms of how we see them as culturally, they do sit really on that gender line. Who thought this would be an interesting conversation? When we came into this, I was thinking, well, we'd be talking about explosions and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and well, we might, I don't know.
We might eventually, but there's one thing I wanted to did want to speak about is the yeah. with Terminator.
Yeah.
No, with Terminator, you have Linda Hamilton as Sarah Connor. And there's a few elements to what I'm going to say here. With and you mentioned Alien, which reminded me. With Alien, you watch Alien, and almost from the off, even though she's not a main character, Sigourney Weaver seems pretty significant. Her importance increases as the film progresses, doesn't it? As she isn't killed and everyone else is, essentially. So you've got two very good actresses playing very strong characters, and there's a lot of character dialogue in both movies as well. In The Terminator, you've got the, you know, most of the character dialogue really is between Sarah Connor and her flatmate.
Yeah.
And what happens in the police station prior to the Terminator's invasion of the police station. And you can get into this stuff with Kyle Reese as well, but that is essentially exposition, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I find these to be very strong, compelling characters, regardless of what sex or gender they are. The current fad seems to be, for science fiction, to be in some way mimicking Princess Leia or putting Princess Leia on some sort of pedestal that, frankly, although Carrie Fisher was a great actress, the character of Princess Leia and the majority of her characterization through dialogue, etc., does not deserve. And we're in a position where, certainly in family movies, female characters in sci-fi are essentially retreads of Princess Leia rather than Ellen Ripley or Sarah Connor. And I find it strange that we've got to this position when you've already got these very strong female characters in science fiction.
I like how, because you're in your car, you're starting to sound like a boxy, angry old man. I can feel a hand waving and spittle about to occur.
There was no spittle, but I was gesturing.
You were gesturing, bless. Yeah, have you got? Do you have modern day examples of some of these that you are?
I would love to give you some actual names, but I can't remember the names. My little girl, my youngest, watches a lot of these kind of kids dramas and cartoons, and they all have these sort of the science fiction. There's a family in space cartoon, and the little girl is a very much a sort of very similar to the young Princess Leia in Kenobi.
Well, I suppose it depends on what sort of archetypes you're going for, doesn't it? I mean, I think with both Ripley and Sarah Connor, I think the fascinating thing is you get to Aliens and Terminator 2, they become, despite both of them having very maternal characteristics in those films, with Sarah Connor obviously having a son, Ripley mourning the loss of her daughter, gaining Newt.
Yeah.
They are quite the way that they work. They are kind of transformed into very masculine characters, that because it's like, well, you know, it's like the, they don't give fucks now. You know, this is it. This time it's war. They do a turnaround, don't they? So from no longer being the fleeing female victim, they become a female aggressor. But the way it's done is quite masculine. They become very oiled up, very muscly, you know, or they start to look like they sort of transform into kind of very, very male character types. While in the first films, they are vulnerable females, but they are, or certainly for Sarah Connor, become stronger females through it. I think it's just interesting with Sarah Connor that she ends up becoming quite an interesting mix, to be fair, of sort of male and female archetypes, because she is very maternal. But to some degree, even her maternalism starts to become quite non-maternal. She becomes quite distant and quite aggressive to her son for a while until she sort of comes to terms. And that's not because she hates him, it's because she loves him. But the way that she displays that is not in sort of ways that we sort of think of women relationships with. So there's so many things about gender in this which are fascinating.
I was reading an interview with James Cameron last night where he expressed some embarrassment over some of the visual effects. Now, I imagine it's the bit with Arnold Schwarzenegger's eye that possibly is the bit that he's not keen on, because it does feel a little... It doesn't stand up well now, but, I mean, it's absolutely fine for 1984.
I don't think it's that bad. I mean, I haven't seen it in a while, but I think because he's... Because he's a motherfucking robot.
Well, yeah, exactly, yeah. But I can't think of any other effect that it could be. Everything else seems absolutely fine. The explosions are fine. The, you know, walking through walls and all that stuff stands up. Driving, through, you know, ramming the police station, etc. It all works fine, in my opinion. Even the model work. The model work in the flash forward sequences as well is superb.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose some of the stop animation of the Terminator at the end, while I think works for the Terminator, it's how it's composited, obviously, onto the background doesn't always look great. But again, I think the movement of stop animation worked really well for that character. And I know, again, it probably makes us sound very old, but I certainly find there's something far more creepy about that approach to animating a character than the sort of fluidity that you get with computers.
I think we once had a conversation like this about Ed 209 in Robocop.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
But then I tend to find that a lot of creators get their stuff wrong when they get older. I mean, I find it unbelievable that Atkinson and Curtis hate the first season of Blackadder, which I think is an incredible bit of work and very funny in a lot of ways. Okay, it's not got the same style and punch as the others, but the fact that they tried to not have it seen. And again, going back to the recent conversation we had it with the interview regarding Red Dwarf, the whole notion of that first series of Red Dwarf literally being mothballed, for as long as they could. Well, I think it's actually some of the most sophisticated, in a weird way, of all the series, because it has no explosions or high sci-fi, or it does have some, but it doesn't have that to support it. It just has to work purely as a story of two guys stuck on a ship, and it works. I think it's incredible, and yet the creators are quite embarrassed by it.
Quick interruption to the podcast. James, as you will have noticed, mentioned Red Dwarf there in his chat with Tom Selinsky a couple of weeks ago. Quick reminder that we are still running our giveaway for a copy of Red Dwarf Discovering the TV Series, Volume 1, 1988 to 1993. We've got a copy to give away here by Tom Selinsky. And all you need to do is be a member of our Patreon. It's as simple as that. A free member or a paid member, it's up to you. So head to patreon.com/Casterbridge, sign up, and you are automatically entered into the draw for a copy of this book, Red Dwarf, Discovering the TV Series, Volume 1. Okay, back to the podcast.
And again, it comes down to actors as well. I've, you know, we'll talk about Blake Seven in the future, but Stephen Pacey, who played Tarrant, was always like, kind of doesn't get the interest in Tarrant, because Tim's like, he had no personality. And it's like, well, for me as a watcher, you as the actor gave him the personality. And you don't see it, but I do. He was cool. And it's funny how those who are involved creatively, when they look back, they have a different perception of some of the stuff to those who actually consumed it and enjoy it in a different way. But yeah, I think Terminator holds up pretty damn well. I think you could even argue there's some of Terminator 2, which perhaps struggles in the long run. I mean, the CG is still okay, it's quite basic, but it's still quite effective, but it's still obviously, it's as obviously unreal as the stop animation approach in Terminator.
I think,
and there's,
I
mean, this is some terrible stunt doubles as well. Sorry, yeah.
Yes, there is. The thing with the CG in
the Terminator 2, beg your pardon, is that I don't think it's ever looked bad, because I think maybe because it is used sparingly. I don't think it's ever looked like bad. Whereas, I don't know, there are examples of CGI from, you know, 25 years ago, which don't look as good.
Well, you could go around the same time period and talk about Alien 3 and the alien dog, which is particularly bad, and there's just no way around that, and you can't escape it by, like with the Terminator 2, you can sort of go, well, it is an alien, well, it's not an alien, it is a synthetic creature, you know, who knows what that would look like, but you get a good sense that alien dog just doesn't look good in its CG moments. So yeah,
I remember at the time of Alien 3 coming out that they delayed it, and the story was that they were doing reshoots because the ending was too similar to Terminator 2, and what we got was a film with the ending that was almost identical to Terminator 2.
Well, that would make sense. You've got molten lava, haven't you, and someone...
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But I want to know how they reshot it. Like, what did they reshoot and then think that it was less like Terminator 2 with the ending that they actually released?
I mean, I wonder... Again, I don't know if it's a phantom memory, but would it her being lowered into the lava rather than jumping in?
Maybe.
But, I mean, yeah, that film has loads of issues outside of that, obviously. Again, we seem to be talking more about 80s franchise sequels, which is a bigger topic, but Terminator is very much at the heart of that. And I suppose in a weird way, you know, the 80s is kind of like one of those tipping points for sequel culture, isn't it? I mean, obviously there were sequels before. You can look at James Bond as a massive example of sequels. You know, there were sequels before the 80s, but the 80s, and, you know, when we get this sort of new Hollywood summer blockbuster shift in Hollywood, you know, sequels start to play a very big part in that. And so we get a really interesting assortment of sequels, of successes and failures, which are peppered through that period, which are really interesting, and some which obviously are not. But yeah, Terminator is an interesting one, because you wouldn't really imagine it's got much sequel potential aside from being a horror movie. You could see them doing a Terminator 2 and it just being the same sort of level, a different girl, different Terminator, perhaps a lower budget, you know, you could see it going down that sort of horror sequel line, but they didn't. It went, you know, they put more money into it and made it bigger, which I think was really unusual. Well, it's obviously quite unusual at the time, but not unusual for Cameron, who had done it with Aliens. But yeah, no, it's a good film. I've not seen it in a long time, but I have a lot of respect for it. A lot of, solid memories. You've seen that you've seen the recent interviews with Arnold talking about O.J. Simpson as being one of the first potential castings for the Terminator.
Yes.
Which he has a bit of fun on. I'm not going to go into it because I won't be able to do it, but okay. if you find that interview, it's kind of he's kind of cheeky about some of the points in that.
Facebook again. I was scrolling through Facebook, and some clips from Naked Gun came up.
Yeah, they've been doing the rounds of late.
Yeah, and, you know, there's when the O.J. Simpson... I mean, they try not to have too much O.J. Simpson in it, I think, the people make the clips, but it does kind of... You know, that whole thing, it does sort of leave you thinking, well, I don't... I love these movies, but I haven't been watching for a long time, partially because of O.J. Simpson, I think, really. That sort of whole, and then you know, doing what he was believed to have done, and then even denying it, but not denying it, you know, right to the end, it kind of leaves you feeling a little, even more uncomfortable about the whole thing, I think.
Well, it's that age-old question, isn't it? Is that if there is someone external to a project blemishes it, is it right to feel you can't, you know, do you feel comfortable watching it anymore? And some people would say, well, that's not fair, because for that one person, there is a massive crew who worked on that, who put their heart and soul into it, have made it a great movie, you shouldn't kind of almost like boycott or cancel a movie just because of one person. And yet at the same time, if that person and whatever's happened has impacted your ability to enjoy that movie emotionally, which isn't people's fault on the crew, and it's not your fault as a human being, but you just don't get the same pleasure, that's it, isn't it? If it makes you feel a bit uncomfortable seeing certain scenes with a certain person, invariably, I think you can't help but back away a bit and go, I don't get the same pleasure out of this anymore because I now am pulled out of the film whenever I see that person, or I'm pulled out of that show. I guess that's the danger of time and legacy.
Indeed. Back to the Terminator. It topped the box office for 2 weeks in the United States. It cost $6.4 million to make, and it grossed $78.3 million in total. So you can see why they were probably thinking when the sequels came around, we'll put some money into this because it's worth it.
Yeah, but I mean, as we know, as Joker has proved, that can still be quite dangerous.
Yeah.
But then the difference would be, I guess, like with recently with Joker, is that Terminator kind of recognized its core audience, and it's while Joker 2 kind of almost reacts and distances itself. You know, you create a Scorsese-like thriller that's got a sort of very male focused and carries very sort of male gendered emotional connections, and then you do a second film for what, three times the budget? Was it 200 million in the end? I can't remember, compared to 60. Big budget jump, but you do a totally different type of film regardless of what you think of the film itself. That might be a red warning there. There may be a red flag poking up that might not be a good move. But Terminator, as you said, was kind of a very clever way of like, this did really well at this level. If we do the same thing but make it bigger, which is just so 80s, isn't it? We'll do the same thing but make it bigger. We will get bigger money.
The budget on the second movie was $94 million, and it made around $520 million.
I remember the time it was big. You know, I remember the conversations about it being big because it was around the same time as obviously Batman, which at the time was big conversations because of Nicholson's fee for it. You know, this idea of these blockbusters now getting out of control was very much a discourse at the back end of the 80s, early 90s, where Terminator and Batman sit. Yeah. But it was this like, let's just go big.
And there was also a spate as well, probably due to Cameron as well, and what he did with Terminator the first time around. He was obviously brought on to direct Alien, and Terminator 2 was obviously his baby anyway. But you've got two movies with like that are sequels with huge gaps between the original movie and the sequel. You've got Alien, which was definitely 1979. I think Aliens is 1987.
86,
beg your pardon, you're quite right. And then you've got Terminator 1984, Terminator 2 1991.
Yeah. It's weird how that seems big these days but now when you think of that period of time, you think, well, that was kind of just before COVID. The pandemic.
But at the same time, there was a time, wasn't there, when, you know, you mentioned Bond earlier, and I would say there's probably an argument that Bond movies aren't sequels. Bond movies are serializations of books up until Daniel Craig. Probably up until Pierce Brosnan.
Hold me back. But they're not sequels, they are serializations of books. Serializations are sequels, carry on. They are continuous.
What I was going to say is you would be regularly, you know, you would know when a Bond movie is coming out. It's usually every 2 years, certainly between 1962 and 1986, 1987. Apart from that small 3-year gap in the 70s, it was a period when, you know, bands would bring out an album every year.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have to wait like 5 or 6 years between albums from bands because they were like living life for Riley or whatever, because they were determined to, and maybe it was because of the amount of money that they were making, they just felt like they had to, you know, churn it a bit, you know, do the grind. But you'd get albums coming out every year, you'd get singles coming out every year, you would get them on tour every year.
Yeah. And that's, no, you're right.
It doesn't happen now. And I think that's why it seemed like such a large period of time between the Terminator and Terminator 2. It's almost, I mean, like, they're almost a generation apart in terms, you know, if you're like, if you're nearly of an age to go and see an 18 or a 15 or whatever in 1984, by the time 1991 comes around, you know, you're leading a completely different life, aren't you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I totally agree. And I think that is fascinating because, again, we'll talk about Blake 7 another day, but I was just thinking a while ago that when I got the first VHSs for Blake 7, it'd probably been around about 1989, around about then. I think they came out as, they'd been out as video library releases, which were horrendously expensive to buy, yeah, about 50 quid. But the 999 range came out at the very, very back end of the 80s. And at the time I was like, I was blown away. It's like, it's been so long to actually see this again. It was like 9 years. It was finished in 81. And yet that period of time seemed like forever, because, and I think part of that's not just because we were younger and so obviously had less lifespan to ratio, but I think it's also, as you say, because everything that came out regularly.
Yeah.
Things that disappeared for even a few years felt like they were gone, and for them to reappear again, I mean, again, going to Doctor Who, you know, the gap between in Baker's, you know, where the show was suspended for a bit,
yeah,
felt a lot longer. Well, you know, that period now is kind of what we kind of have had, you know, default, an 18-month.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think there's an interesting rhythm to distribution in the 80s, which those kind of films disrupted by and almost laid the groundwork for where cinema would invariably go. Because if you're going to do a massive big thing after something that's successful, you need to see how successful it is. Then to plan the bigger thing, these, you know, you don't, a 2-year cycle is just not enough.
No.
You need more. So invariably it kind of signaled the way that there was going to need to have a longer run up to sequels if those sequels were going to need more attention. Maybe. I don't know. Speculating here. This is just interesting stuff. I'm sure there's loads of exceptions to these rules we're talking about. But I think you're right. There is that interesting flow of material in the 80s. And, of course, you could also argue to some degree everything was a little more predictable, maybe. I mean, at the moment, you know, who knows where the market's going to go? You know, who knows where media consumption's going? You know, documentaries are down, streaming is crazy and everywhere. You know, live, you know, broadcast television struggles, but it's still there. Cinema struggling in different ways. You know, who would have suspected the second Joker film would have done what it did, when anyone outside the industry would have surely said that was a crazy move? So everything is, I don't know, it somehow seems far more unpredictable and chaotic to, as you say, the interesting rhythms of releases. You know, where I think a lot of the time it was about, you know, getting things out for a summer or a Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, those are your end games. We don't tend to have that sort of space anymore.
I've noticed that documentaries are moving into the cinema. There seems to be more documentaries, or certainly more documentaries being released as, you know, I don't want to say primary features, but they're getting the sort of distribution that they didn't used to get.
Mm.
Whether cinema or whether on like premium streaming platforms like Apple or whatever, or Disney Plus. You've got the Beatles things, for example. And although it wasn't really a documentary, I suppose, you've got the Tetris movie a couple of years ago. But there's other sort of things that are based in the whole video game arena that have been that are becoming documentaries as well, I've noticed. Which is interesting.
I mean, again, it'll be something to talk about another time, but I think the impact of video games, especially in the last 10, 15 years cannot be overlooked, because one, on the fact that video games, in terms of, we're looking at the video games themselves, in terms of development, in terms of sequel and franchises, require more time than the old cycle that we're talking about that you perhaps would have for a film. But also just the sheer time sink that video games now create for generations. I mean, we're talking about, we talk about people our age are playing video games, as well as people who are like teens, which when we were a kid, it would have just been teens largely playing video games. So you've got a whole generation hooked on something which is a massive time sink. How does that impact on people having time to watch a full season of something coming up, or going to the cinema when you've got this, I've played for thousands of hours on games. You know, that's thousands of hours which 20, 30 years ago would have been committed to television and film and books, maybe. Who knows? Maybe not. Comics. So I think thinking about where the video games sit in all this and all these changes and the flow is fascinating. You know, like you said, you know, I mean, I wonder how many hours you've played on that RoboCop game. I bet it's more than 90 minutes that you'd have taken to watch the first film.
Yeah.
So that space is really interesting, just trying to sort of see what this means to making stuff. And I think Terminator's another reason why Terminator's a fascinating one is outside those first two movies, everything has struggled to land. And I do wonder if part of the mistake of that is, going back to what I was saying initially, is a misunderstanding of what made Terminator work so well. And I think that is in some respects arguably what Alien Romulus is trying to capture, is to go back to its roots. And you could do Terminator with different people, you could do them in different time zones and just play the same thing as the same film. You could do one set in Victorian London, and a person Terminator comes for them. You know, you could follow the same, but that sort of model's never been replicated. It's just become more convoluted and more complex and more about the time travel elements rather than the notion of futuristic unstoppable stalkers. I think it's a fascinating to see where Terminator is and how we can see it with hindsight now to where, how muddled that franchise has become.
When many, many years ago, as it is now, 9 years ago, Terminator Genesis came out.
Yes.
And Matt Smith was in it, wasn't he, if you recall?
Yeah, I didn't mind that film, to be honest. I mean, it blew me away, but...
I didn't like the casting, generally. I think that's...
I didn't like the casting. I liked the use of Arnie in it. The casting... and I kind of liked the idea, as I know I've said, the time travel stuff killed the franchise. And I think Genesis is an example of that. Personally, being someone who has watched Doctor Who and Back to the Future and the likes, kind of enjoyed that bit. But I can understand why it didn't help the franchise. But yeah, the casting definitely didn't work for me.
Yeah, so I understand Matt Smith is making a movie at the moment. And there's obviously this long-running opinion that I have that any movie Matt Smith goes into is an instant flop, whereas on TV he's guaranteed either critical acclaim or top ratings. It's like a magical unwritten law about Matt Smith or whatever. But anyway, back to the Terminator. We were talking about video games. I've looked this up because I didn't know this. I know that there was a Terminator 2 game, which was generally the same across platforms.
There are several different
games for the Terminator.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. There's one. The first one came out in 1988. No, it didn't. It was actually the company went into receivership. Then there's another one. Yeah. One in 1989 came out for the Nintendo Entertainment System.
So did that first one not come out?
The first one's ever come out? No. There's actually an excellent Twitter and website called Games That Weren't, which does absolutely sterling work in finding lost games and archiving them. these games that were like cancelled because companies went into receivership, or they were just abandoned and moved on to a different, you know, might have used a different game engine or whatever, or the company was bought out and the project was abandoned or whatever. So this website sort of digs into the archives, gets hold of old hard drives from developers, as an example, and they sort of revive these games and make them available quite often. So I'm going to look that one up and see if that is one that has been made available subsequently. There's been games from on DOS and the Sega Mega Drive and Master System and Game Gear, and these are all coming up. These are all overlapping the release of Terminator 2 as well, mostly. So at some point you would have games of Terminator 2 based on the movie, and also these games called The Terminator, which would range between largely putting you in control of Carl Reese. Now that's why I was mentioning this. None of them appear to put you in control of Sarah Connor.
Yeah.
They're basically run and gun games.
And again, it's this notion, especially in the 80s, that if you wanted to, you know, that especially video games were male driven, that you'd need to have male main characters and people wouldn't play female. You know, some say, going back into the 80s again with the Hera and She-Ra sequel or co-franchise, you know, they were very concerned about how that would impact on the He-Man franchise when the younger sisters would have She-Ra dolls. Would that take away the masculinity of the He-Man franchise that the kids would, the boys would stop playing with them? So again, this tension of, you know, and we still have it to a degree, you know, we're still always thinking about, you know, what sells. And we've seen how, you know, there are a section of men who will feel quite distant if they're the main characters of a franchise are women. And equally, I'm sure there are women who kind of are disenfranchised if the main characters are men again. And we've had obviously 100 years of men leading franchises. So, you know, you can see on both sides how this becomes a problem for people creating stuff. Like, who do we have as our main people here? It does make a difference, even back in the 80s. When it would be a sprite, which would be, let's face it, pretty much genderless in the 80s. You'd be lucky if you could get any sense of gender from a sprite in a game. A blob, if it's on the Spectrum.
Oh, don't be unfair on the Spectrum.
But that's incredible. I mean, the Spectrum, I know we're going everywhere on this. And the Spectrum, I was just thinking, you know, really its years of success were kind of like 83 to 89, maybe 90 if you're being kind. That's like 7 years. And yet, to me, that feels like a massive era of creativity and change and dynamic pushing of the boundaries. Mm-hmm. 7 years.
7 years. And in the middle of that 7 years, you had the Amiga and the launch with Andy Warhol and Deborah Harry and a digital camera and an art package. And yet, the Spectrum, if anything, after 1984, got more popular. I think, you know, there's several new versions of that come out. And there was a version of Terminator 2 on the Spectrum. And it's not entirely unfair for you to mention the Spectrum, because they're probably going to be on shelves this Christmas in supermarkets.
Yes, I hear. Yeah.
So,
yeah. I mean, there was a few years ago they tried this, didn't they? There was a company that was doing a Spectrum a few years ago and it kind of fell apart.
There's been a few of them, yeah. There was a handheld one. I can't remember the name of that one. Then there was like a completely updated Spectrum called the Spectrum Next, which has a limited production run. You can still get those. But yeah, there was a kind of a £50 one that you could get hold of, but this new one's around £80 and has rubber keys.
Wow.
Yeah. And has the games pre-installed, but not all of them. And I don't know if Terminator 2 is one of them. But we should probably rewind. But I mean, you know, we're talking about a 40-year-old movie, so it's not totally unfair to mention a 42-year-old computer system.
And these were all, as I say, very connected, very interconnected, because that was a way that, you know, those were where these shows did exist, you know.
And also Alien, where they were marketed
Aliens.
In the video game magazines as well.
Yeah, absolutely. They're all very much part of the same culture.
You had basically, you either had a type of music or you had like movies and TV shows and computer games, and it's pretty much the same group of people and the same band of interests, wasn't it?
And the computer game market for the magazines was very culturally savvy and knew its audience, its teen demographic.
God, yeah.
And was very much played into that mesh. Yeah, very much so. But yeah, and again, like we said, I mean, Alien had its own fascinating Spectrum video game, which is, you know, still kind of stands up. They got, there was two Aliens games on the Spectrum, Aliens and Aliens US, which were very different to each other.
Yeah, we had that on C64 as well, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So you'd have had the mirror there. You know, these, again, in this very short era, this short golden era of the 8-bit, and we can include C64 in this as well, because its era lasted about as long before, as you say, the Amiga and the Atari ST and the Master System and Nintendo took over 90s. Yeah, there was these incredible attempts to try and capture these franchises in these very simplistic game frameworks that, you know, couldn't do that much. You know, probably the most successful, again, was RoboCop. RoboCop was the first big success by Ocean, followed up by an almost identical remapping of that onto the Batman movie.
The RoboCop game, it's better to stick to RoboCop because I don't think I've ever played a Terminator game in the arcades that was anything like the computer game. But the RoboCop game in the arcade and the home port version, they're almost identical. And obviously I'm playing this later RoboCop game now. And as much as I'm enjoying the first person aspect of being RoboCop, there is something about that old arcade game, marching him across the screen, left to right, dealing with punks and Ed 209, that has its own sort of charm, which I kind of, in many ways, I have a nostalgic yearning for when I'm playing the new game.
Yeah, and I must admit, I did look at the new game when you'd mentioned it a few weeks ago, and I was kind of disappointed by it being first person. I don't find first person very immersive in video games. I feel like it's a screen, even though it shouldn't. Mm. And the perspectives, I'd rather have an over the shoulder or clear character. That to me feels more, especially when you're co-opting a visual franchise where you're used to seeing the character. Suddenly for the character not to be visual in those sort of spaces feels weird. I know what it's trying to do, and there is obviously point of view shots within the films as well, but I mean, it's funny, with going back to Terminator, you know, you think of Alien Isolation, you know, which came out now 10 odd years ago.
Yeah,
that would be a very good framework to do a Terminator game. In a sense, you could do that sort of, you know, avoiding an impossible stalker and solving problems to sort of stay out of its reach could work for Terminator.
Mm. Yeah, it could. There was, I think there's a general discussion that there's going to be another Terminator once Avatar's out of the way, once the new Avatar, or as I call them, Pocahontas in space, movies are out of the way. So it'll be interesting to see if James Cameron retires before he does that, or whether it actually happens. To be honest with you, I don't think James Cameron's the type of director who will retire. So it probably will happen at some point. But
I would really like him to do what they never managed to do with the Alien franchise, but they tried to do with Superman, and actually do a direct sequel to. And I suppose the very last Terminator almost sort of kind of tried to do this, but almost like do a direct sequel to this Terminator 2, which ignores everything else, which I can't remember if the last one, what was the last one called? Was it the very last Terminator movie?
Hold on,
its name escapes me.
It's not Salvation. It's
I keep my brain dark. I was wanted to say Dark Salvation, Dark Fate.
Dark Fate. Terminator Dark
Fate. Yeah. I mean, that kind of does that, but doesn't quite. But, you know, and Cameron was involved in that as well, if I recall. Yeah. It's just an exec producer role or something, not big time. But again, I didn't mind that film. It kind of worked, but I think, again, this, but not perfectly. And I think the problem, again, is it gets too trapped in the future now link, which I just don't think is mass. When you think of Terminator, you don't really, Kyle Reese is not, even though he's that linchpin to that, he's not massively part of people's memories of it. He's probably remembered more for Aliens, whereas part is actually less than it is in Terminator. But I just sometimes wonder if you want to go back to basics and get that franchise back, you've got to really try and distill the original movie in a different way to how it's been done since, which is kind of, let's be fair, I mean, and again, I suppose the thing here is what they've been distilling is not Terminator, but Terminator 2. That's the problem, yes. Is every Terminator film after this has been kind of based on either the framework or the sort of bigger ideas that are very much present in Terminator 2, which are a little more simplistic in Terminator.
Yeah, I would say that's fair. So to wrap this up then, I suppose maybe it might be an idea to... I don't know. I mean, it's a bit trite, I suppose, but I was thinking maybe we could rank the Terminator movies.
You can do that.
Okay. But the problem is, it might be the case that the ranking of the Terminator movies in terms of quality and enjoyability are actually the Terminator or Terminator 2, and then, in order, Terminator 3, Terminator Salvation, Terminator Genesis, and Terminator Dark Fate.
Oh, it's a tough one because I found Terminator Salvation utterly boring and lacking a good ending. The original ending was more interesting, but I don't know. I mean, I would say yes. Again, it depends what your pleasures are, isn't it? Between, again, it's the Aliens thing, isn't it? Which is the best film, and I've seen this debate recently a lot. I'd probably say Terminator 2 is more rewatchable. I think Terminator is obviously as the first as well. So as we're talking about sequels, we can ignore Terminator. So I think Terminator 2 is definitely the best of the lot outside of as a sequel.
No, I
think I personally did enjoy Dark Fate a lot more than I think the others. I was interested in Sarah Connor. I thought some of the new characters was interesting and there was a sense of threat. I would put that. I think I'd probably have to put Terminator 3 after it. Just, again, it's that ending, isn't it? But the rest is fairly bland. Again, Genesis, I didn't think was that bad because I think Schwarzenegger held it together. He was kind of fun, even though the rest of the cast just didn't really work.
How many times have you watched it?
Okay, once.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I've never gone back to it. But then I think I've only seen Terminator 3 once.
I've seen Terminator 3 a few times.
But then I didn't like the casting in Terminator 3. I think there was... I think the mistake has always been to make it about, funnily enough, about Sarah Connor or John Connor. I think that's where... And the Dark Horse comics got away from that, and I think that was a good move. But I think bottom line is Salvation would be my last one because it's just one I just didn't enjoy. I found it cold, uncaring, and just uninteresting.
I think, because, you know, most people don't know that Christian Bale made a Terminator movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And the ending, my memory fades to the end, the original ending, but the original ending was far more punchier and darker. And I think that would have made the film in the same way that Terminator 3 is kind of made by having a punchy,
strong ending,
punchy, risky ending. Yeah. So I think I'd probably put Terminator 2, Dark Fate. Then I'd probably put 3 because I think it does make a punch for its bold punch. Then Genesis, which I still kind of enjoyed despite the bad casting. There were some quite good moments in it. And then, Salvation at the end, because I just didn't care about the future war. And it just felt like everyone was a bit bored in it as well. But although I would add, I did quite enjoy the Sarah Connor Chronicles,
which ended after one season. Yeah, I think I've seen a couple of episodes of that, but that's about it.
That was before Hedley became big with Game of Thrones and starred, her name suddenly escaped from me, but River from Firefly. Summer Glau. And again, a flawed series. I can see why they cancelled it, but Lena just didn't really make a good Sarah. And I don't think it was her acting. It was just the way they positioned her and John. They just weren't enjoyable to watch. But Summer Glau was excellent. But I'd put that quite far up there. Ultimately, I think I think I'm sort of trying to say Christian in 10 minutes saying, I really don't care. I'm trying to do this, but I suppose it's a franchise I've always been interested in, but I'm not so invested that when they're not that great, I'm that bothered. So they're not so great ones. I can go, oh, I kind of enjoyed that. But, you know, not that great Star Wars or Back to the Future or, you know, Doctor Who would hit me far harder, I think, than a not great Terminator. What do you think?
Are you asking me or the listener?
I was asking you.
Oh, okay. I mean, I'd largely agree. I'm looking at this and I'm looking at it again and again and again, and I'm pretty sure there was some effort to watch Dark Fate, but I'm beginning to think I haven't seen it. So I don't know whether it was one of those evenings where we sat down to watch something and then we were interrupted by children or whatever. I don't think I've seen Dark Fate, so I'm not really able to give a full account of myself for this. So I would largely say, I, having watched the Terminator and Terminator 2 in the past few weeks, I'm going to say Terminator first, and then Terminator 2, and then Terminator 3. And then, because I don't particularly like Genesis or Salvation, I'm just going to put them both equally at the bottom of the list, tying.
Fair enough.
I haven't watched enough of Sarah Connor Chronicles to be able to give a fair inclusion of that.
I mean, I'm not going to say that tying two films is the coward's answer, but
you wouldn't say that. I know.
I wouldn't say that. Not to the listener, anyway.
But speaking to you, the listener, do let us know what you think of the Terminator movies, and you know, if you have an order of them. You know, ranking system for the Terminator movies, because you've got to have a system. You'll find a thread about this on the Facebook page, so let us know. I'd be very interested to know if we're completely wrong about Terminator Genesis, for example. I don't think we are. Yeah, that would be interesting to know. So yeah, the Terminator is now 40 years old. Incredibly, this low budget science fiction movie is celebrating its fourth, 40 years. It's into its fifth decade. It has been re-released as well. There is a 4K version doing the rounds from 2013, which is accompanied by a bunch of the usual documentaries. And
there's that animated one on Netflix.
Of course, yeah.
Which I started to watch and then was kind of like, hey, it's too dark. This world is too dark. I can't deal with this, and switched off. But it looked very good. It looked very well done.
Yeah. So, and you can watch it on streaming services. I mean, I would recommend taking the time out to, you know, it's roughly 90 minutes long, I think, the Terminator. So 107 minutes, beg your pardon. So, you know, that's an hour and 45 minutes of 1980s top quality sci-fi horror to watch. And it, you know, there are a lot of movies I place alongside the Terminator. There's the Terminator, there's RoboCop, there's Total Recall and The Running Man. Those sort of, they all have a similar sort of, there's nothing
Arnold. Futurist.
Well, they don't all have Arnold, do they? Because RoboCop doesn't have Arnold either, but yeah.
Fair enough.
But you have this sort of slightly near future dystopic atmos to the whole thing. Even though
the highly masculine leads as well,
that as well,
interestingly,
yeah. and not so much in the Terminator movie, but in the others, you know, this reflection of this kind of corporate media seeping through into every.
Total Recall, Running Man,
yeah,
RoboCop. I mean, yeah. It is the era. I mean, there's a shift in the 80s from the fear being the Cold War to corporations.
Yeah,
which kind of catalyses early on with Aliens. I think there's obviously some examples before that, but that to me is the memory of that being the one where suddenly it's about corporate. Well, I suppose Alien, to be fair, because it is.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because when then it's a nice little twist as well, isn't it? So, great movies. And as I say, I tend to lump them all together in my head as being a corporate fear subgenre of science fiction. I don't know.
Yeah.
But So that's The Terminator. Go check it out if you haven't already. And we'll be back for a new show soon. Until then, it's goodbye from us.